Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness today on October 22nd, 2008. We're opening up an informational hearing update on the child care complaint database, and people are going to be coming up who aren't coming up. Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Gentlemen and members of the committee, on behalf of the Oregon Commission for Child Care, thank you for inviting us to share with you about our involvement in the Child Care Complaint Database.
And we need to know your name.
I'm Heidi McGowan. I'm the Executive Officer of the Commission for Child Care. And is that all you need to know?
Great.
The Commission for Child Care is a body of 18 volunteers appointed by the governor. Representative Kotek is one of our committee members. Good to see you this morning.
Good to see you.
18 volunteers are appointed by the governor, Speaker of the House, and President of the Senate, and it's an advisory body on issues, problems, and solutions related to the affordability and the quality of child care in Oregon. And we advocate for the availability of safe, quality, and affordable child care. In November of 2008, a group of parents who had children enrolled at a local child care center here in Salem came to discuss concerns with the Commission for Child Care. The parents had recently learned that the employees at the child care center had contacted the child care division regarding concerns about the care children were receiving at the site. When complaints were found valid and the center was closed down by the child care division, the parents were upset that they were not notified that there was a history of valid complaints. While parents could always contact the child care division for complaint history, the child care division does not systematically notify parents of every facility with a complaint found valid. The parents came to the Commission for Child Care asking for help so that in the future, parents such as themselves would have information about a facility if these complaints were found valid. The Commission for Child Care held a lengthy discussion regarding the need for consumer notification and consumer protection when purchasing child care services. The Child Care Division responded promptly and proposed a solution to post valid complaints online so that parents could access information about child care facilities history. Within 2 months, the Child Care Division had complaint history up online that was found valid, and so that every child care facility in Oregon was accessible to parents. The information was accessible. We'll continue to work with the Child Care Division to ensure that consumers of child care in Oregon have information to make their best decision about where to purchase child care services. We're currently also working with the Child Care Division on a project that's called the Quality Indicators Project, which will also inform parents about the level of quality that is available in Oregon. It's a couple of projects, but this is an exciting one that was in response to a consumer need.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, representatives of the committee members, my name is Kathleen Hines, and I'm the Legal and Compliance Manager with the Child Care Division. And I'm here to talk to you a little bit about the details of the database. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you this morning, and I'm pleased to report that since its inception in February 2008, about 9 months ago, we have averaged 14,000 inquiries per month, or hits per month, as they're called, for web-based information, for a total of 126,000 inquiries. Of course, the first week or so, we had 20,000 because all of the providers went online to see what kind of history was being put up there. But again, it's averaged out to about 14,000, and I'm assuming those are primarily parents that are checking. And they're getting real-time information. The database is updated overnight, every night. And as Heidi mentioned, some of the concerns that the parents had were that information was available, but they would have to call the child care division to get that information. And, of course, we don't want parents calling once a week saying anything new, anything new. This gives them an opportunity to look at that on their own time. So just as a way to educate you a little bit about what parents see, I've attached several screen prints in the material that I provided you. so that you can see what parents are seeing on the website. And the very first screen, friend, is the facility with no complaints. And you can access, a parent or anyone can access this information by typing in a zip code and getting all the facilities that are in that zip code, a particular provider's name. They can type that in and get that information, or if you have the license number, it can go straight to that facility. So, or a phone number. So there's a number of ways to access the information, and you don't have to do one facility at a time. This particular screen print reflects a facility that has had no complaints, and you might note it says no complaint, valid complaint since January 2004. That's when we started our electronic system, so we do tell people that this only goes back to 2004. If there were valid complaints before that, you would still have to call the division to get those, just the limits of technology. The next screen print shows a facility that has two valid complaints. And the way this information is reflected on the screen is it just shows the rules that were violated. So it doesn't say what the allegation was. It doesn't say what the factual finding was. In order to get that, and I also, it indicates that you can have a violation of more than one rule. So that's why it says number one, and there's three valid rule violations there, and then there's number two and one rule violation. So if a parent wants more information about, well, I can see that, you know, there was a violation of the rule about sight and sound and being within sight or sound of children at all times and being aware of what they're doing. What exactly happened there? They'll have to call the division to get that information because it is just too much. You know, at some point we'll put all of that on the web, but again, there are certain technological limitations to that. And so that facility would shows that it has two valid complaints. The next screen shows that what happens if you type in the name of a facility that no longer has an active license. So they'll know that too. There may be facilities out there that are now doing exempt care, caring for three or fewer children. It would indicate that they're no longer licensed. So the parent would have that information too. I mean, they may still choose to use that provider, but they would know they're not licensed. And the last screen shows a facility that has been suspended. And you'll see that the status of it shows Jacqueline Smith. And by the way, these are made-up names and license numbers. That it shows that it's suspended, and you think, well, gee, it's suspended, but there's no complaints listed here. That's because the whole processing of the complaint process has not been completed, but we want parents to know that there was imminent danger in that facility, that the license has been suspended, and the rest of the information will be forthcoming. We also, on most pages, and you can even go back to the first screen print, it says complaint assessments are not completed or not displayed, and for compliance history, contact the child care division at the phone numbers listed above. We encourage, throughout the web page, we encourage parents to continue to contact the child care division to get a more complete compliance history. And by that, we mean this only lists valid complaints. If you call us, you will get information on complaints that we were unable to substantiate. You also get information on the good things that providers are doing, that they've got more training than is required by law, for example, or that they've passed every health and safety review on the first time. We've never had to go back for corrections. So they'll get a more complete picture. This gives parents and consumers an entree to the information about a facility, but we continue to encourage them to call us to get a more complete picture. And the number of calls that we are getting to inquire about compliance history has gone up since we've put this information on the web. So I think parents are looking at this and realizing they need or want more information and contacting us to get that. So we consider this a success, and we're going to continue to work with it and continue to refine it and get as much information up there as we possibly can.
Kathleen, what proportion of child care facilities are licensed?
You mean including everyone that's doing exempt care?
I don't know what exempt care.
Well, exempt under the statute, a person in the state of Oregon can care for up to three children, unrelated children besides their own, without being licensed. And you can also operate a preschool for 4 hours or less a day without being licensed. So there are a number of child care settings or child caring settings that are exempt from licensure under the law. Then there are also those folks out there who are
providing what we call illegal care. They're caring for more than three children, but they're not licensed. And when we hear about those, we go out and investigate. So I believe there's a very large proportion of individuals providing exempt care, care to three children or fewer in the state, probably a higher proportion in Oregon than in many other states in the country.
So how many children, give me an idea of how many children would be in those exempted child care settings as opposed to the ones that are licensed?
They're licensed. I have a number in my head. I'm not sure it's accurate. I'd really prefer to get back to you with that number. I think it was, do you remember?
I don't, and I know we don't know exactly because we don't have a database of it.
Yeah.
Could you make sort of a just a ballpark guess? Half?
Half? Oh, more than half.
Are in
unlicensed care.
Okay.
In Oregon.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Part of what we, you know, part of the efforts that the commission works with a division on is to encourage providers, provide training opportunities, financial incentives to encourage individuals to get licensed. They're in the DHS subsidy program for low-income parents, the child care subsidy program, for example. A licensed provider gets higher level of payment, for example, than an unlicensed provider. So there are incentives out there to encourage people to get licensed and meet those minimum health and safety standards.
Yeah.
You have a question?
Yeah, I do. I had a concern that the database wasn't easily findable. You couldn't find it. And so I Googled it last night, and I found it. But one of the issues is, and this is a perennial question in websites, is to make it as user-friendly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And on the front screen, it's, you have to read all this stuff, and there's this little button at the bottom that says, I've read everything, and I would just encourage the department to make it as accessible as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, how are the daycares informing the parents? Do they have an obligation to inform the parents that this database exists?
Mm-hmm.
Do they encourage people? Do they use it as a marketing tool? Because, I mean, if you have no, I mean, I went through and most of them had no complaints. I just did my zip code.
Mm-hmm.
And I would want parents, if I had no complaints, to, you know, I would encourage them to do it. And then the other question to follow on to that is the positive stuff. You know, we always are negative, and you said there's a plate you can call and get positive, but is it a reasonable expectation that we could put on, instead of just complaints, we had compliments? I don't know if that is feasible or not.
Representative Maurer, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, we're always interested in comments on accessibility. Part of it was wanting to encourage individuals that are going on the website to educate themselves first about the difference between complaints and compliance history, because we have a concern, too, that a parent will go on and say, oh, one complaint, forget it. And that doesn't tell the whole story. And so, you know, that balance between trying to encourage them to read. And, of course, we work within the limits of the government template, too. But we will look at that and always want to work to make it more accessible. The other piece that you're talking about, eventually I think we'll have most of our licensing information on the web, but that has to do with imaging and limitations as well. We do explain what additional information they'll get with compliance history. Maybe there's a way we can brighten that up a little bit or emphasize the positive a little bit more, too. In terms of putting that up on the web right now, we really don't have the technological ability to do that.
Representative Maurer, I mentioned briefly the other project called the Child Care Quality Indicators Project, and the entire purpose of that is to inform parents about the quality of child care in Oregon, and it's a project that has been piloting for the last 3 years. It's currently launching statewide, so within a year we'll have that information, and we're in the development phase of developing the website so that parents will have information about 7 indicators of quality, and so it will be more positive focused versus just complaint history, which is now accessible on the Child Care Division website. So there's a strong desire to get consumer information out there that is accessible.
Can I follow up? Thank you. When they fill out, I'm assuming that every parent fills out an application, I mean, because the child's name, and does the state require certain items to be on that application?
Representative Maurer, are you talking about parents who are enrolling their children in child care? That relationship is between the parent and the child care provider. So we don't have access to parent information or children's information.
That's not my question. It gets back to how do the facilities inform parents that in fact this database exists?
Right.
Are they doing it? I'm assuming it's not required.
We have a whole system of resource and referral agencies throughout the state. Many of them are housed in community colleges. Many parents go to those, use the resource and referral system to get information on providers, and they will inform parents. They provide that information to parents that they can look on the web, that they can call us and get that kind of information. So parents get that information that way. We do encourage providers. Providers are aware of this system, and so, of course, those that don't have any complaints, I would assume that they would use that as a marketing technique to say, you can go on and look at my history on the website. It's a continuing challenge for us on the best way to get information out to parents and educate them. We, you know, any opportunity we get to talk to the media, we do. Any opportunity we get to provide information through the resource and referral system, we do.
But the child care provider is not required to give this information to the parents of the children in their care.
No, they're required to post their license, and they're required to post the division's phone number.
But,
with that
but they don't have to give them a piece of paper and say, this is how you can see our history.
Not at this point, no.
Is that what you're sort of getting at?
It is, but if they're required to post their license, they're required to post the phone number,
mm-hmm.
It seems that in that, because this would be a rule, that mm-hmm. they borrow the phone number, we should have a website.
Yeah, I don't think the website is on there now, but we can certainly do that. That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm done with my good ideas.
Representative Kote. Thank you, Madam Chair. And that might be something for the Child Care Commission to come back and, mm-hmm. you know, the database came up in February, and I think it's really helpful to point out the speed at which the department was able to respond to the parents' concern. Mm-hmm. Hence, obviously, this is focused on complaints, but, you know, given the conversations we were having back in February about other databases for other providers, I think it was really important for us to showcase that given within the resources available at the department and what was available, you were able to get something up pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you should all be congratulated for that. But I do think we should come back at the commission and talk about, you know, and I think the posting requirements are probably in rule, not in statute, I would assume.
They're in rule, yes.
So we could maybe look at that, mm-hmm. of adding it.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Heidi and Kathleen, I have two questions. First one, either one of you can chip in on it. What is the level of burden proof for determining when allegations sustained?
No, I have that.
Beyond reasonable doubt, right?
Pardon me?
Beyond reasonable doubt.
Well,
just joking. Just joking.
Representative Olson, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, we actually have that in writing, and that is if there is, I don't know if we say evidence that it happened, we will find it valid. Unable to substantiate or unsubstantiated is there is no evidence that it happened or didn't happen, or there's conflicting evidence, and that will be unable to substantiate. If there's no evidence that it happened, then it's considered invalid.
Okay. Sounds like it's probably reasonable suspicion then is what you're at for that burden.
Yeah, we do get, for example, if there's an allegation that they're caring for more children than are permitted under the law. If we arrive and there's more children, clearly that's valid. We will also look at enrollment records. If there's a written record that they had more children there, that would be valid. So there has to be some evidence that it occurred.
Again, and just one more question. Thank you. I like the idea where you're going, and it kind of spins off a little bit of what Representative Maurer was talking about for the project quality care that you're thinking of doing and creating. That any consideration of maybe plugging the two databases in together into one?
So. Go ahead, sure. Representative Olson, absolutely, we'll link those things. There's the purpose of the quality indicators is to inform parents about quality, and absolutely we'll want to link these things. And that's something, great feedback right now as we look at developing this website. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Gelfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you had any complaints from the child care providers who are listed in the database about being listed in the database?
Representative Gelser, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. We've had providers express concern about it. They've expressed concern about that it's the rule that's listed and not the factual piece of the complaint, which would benefit some providers perhaps and probably do more harm to some providers depending on your perspective. Some providers would like to see, again, some of the more positive information up on the website as well. And so, you know, again, that's something that we're working on.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? I just thank you so much for your presentation. I think probably you got calls from constituents, as did I, about an egregious case that had hit the Oregonian about a child that had been burned, I think, placed in very, very hot water. Mm-hmm. And so they asked, how could the state not react? Of course, we reacted. This was a child abuse case. But it sounds like there was nothing in your department that you could have done because this was not a licensed facility. Is that correct?
Representative Tomei, that's correct. This was a neighbor babysitting a neighbor's child.
Right.
And so there was no involvement by our or knowledge of it by our division until that unfortunate incident.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Does this follow the person if they are licensed for one home or they close down a facility, open another one?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work if, you know, people change facilities or, you know, sell out and sell to somebody else and that type of thing?
Well, the license follows, in general, follows the individual. It's as usual. It depends somewhat situation. When you have a registered family child care home or a certified family child care home, the license is with the person. So if that person moves, they have to reapply and get a new license. And so that compliance history would follow them. When you have a child care center, the license goes to the director, and that's one of the reasons we try to we encourage parents or consumers to contact us, because you could have, for example, a fairly negative compliance history for a year, and it may be because there's a poor director or there was a teacher who wasn't very good in that facility, and then you get a new regime in or new staff in, and it's a wonderful facility that has, you know, incredible program activities for children. So, but in answer to your question, it follows the provider. Yes.
But couldn't just the opposite happen? Couldn't a child care worker that was working in one of these facilities who had a complaint and left that facility and went to another one, does the complaint follow her or him?
Chair Tomei, that complaint would be on the website connected to the facility. So it would be the job of the facility that's hiring that person to do the background check on, and get references on how that person had performed at their previous employment.
But if they didn't let the new employer know that they had had problems in previous employment, there would be no way for the new employer to know that there had been a problem. Is that correct?
The only way the new employer would know that is to look up on the web, look up if they know where this person worked in the past.
But what I'm saying is if they don't let them know where they worked in the past.
Right, right.
So it doesn't follow the person. It just follows the facility.
The licensee, yes.
Gelfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under House Bill 2175 that we passed in 07, where there is the department-wide through DHS abuse database that's being built. Would they be picked up through that, and when they go to the new employer and the criminal records check is done and they do the background check through the other abuse histories, would they ping up through that?
I represent gals or members of the committee. I would have to defer to DHS for that answer. I'm just going to leave it at that, because anything else I say, well, I believe that has to do with child abuse, and a person can violate our regulations, you know, for example, lack of supervision of children. It could violate our rules, but not rise to the level of child abuse. So they may not end up in that database as a result of violating one of our rules.
Can I follow up?
Follow up.
Thanks. And my understanding, and maybe that's a question for the department, and we can follow up later, maybe Patty can. My understanding is that the abuse database that's being created at DHS isn't just a child abuse database, but it goes through mental health and seniors and physical disability and developmental disability, with the idea being that a provider might move from one silo of human service to another, and you want to be able to follow that pattern of abuse from one place to another. And I think what I'm wondering is, since child care is regulated through the employment division, whether or not that information would feed into that database, or if in the discussion of the implementation of 2175, maybe that's something to discuss to make sure they get picked up as well.
Sure.
What I was asking about may not rise to the level of abuse, just a problem that this person might have had in the child care center. But and I agree that the abuse would probably, the allegation of abuse would follow, but I'm concerned that there may not be that information that follows this new person in a new position.
And just to clarify, we do have the criminal history registry, or we do background checks on anyone who has an affiliation with a child care facility. So that information does follow the individual.
Right.
So.
You're going to follow on this. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's just important to clarify what the department is this a good provider from the rules set up to say you're providing an attempt to meet child care regulations on how you provide care. I do think the abuse issue, I'm wondering if what we passed last session, or the connection between the DHS and the employment department around when abuse does occur in the child care setting. So I think we're probably catching some of that, but then it becomes a DHS abuse issue. But there is, you know, there are many things that would not even come close to the level of abuse that could be a rule violation. So it's an apples and oranges kind of conversation.
Okay. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gelser's question reminded me how many times we've talked about databases with all kinds of issues. And this isn't your responsibility to coordinate all of the State of Oregon's databases, but it does bring to mind, and I'd like to know your answer in your area, as we utilize the Internet, or as they say in Representative Maurer's district, the internets, as as we utilize the internet, has great possibility to inform parents and all that, but I'm concerned about the folks that are putting that information in. I'm not specifically concerned about your department, but I'm saying is, you know, what is their level of background both in information technology and in child care? What's the coordination with other departments? What's the cost? What's the standard our state has as we all develop databases in an attempt to get more information out? What is the level of security and accuracy and so forth that your folks are held to?
Representative Gilliam and members of the committee, when we I can address that as far as, for example, our criminal history background check, where we check the background, criminal backgrounds and child protective history. All individuals that do those background checks, well, there's four or five, all have led certification, law enforcement data system certification, so they have a high level of security. We comply with state police and LEDS rules around that. We have a secure area. We have, you know, computer screens and a high level of training on confidentiality. So all of that information, so we do have a high level of training on that. That information is not available to the public in any way, shape, or form. The information about licensure and about compliance with rules and non-compliance with rules is all public information. So for us, it's a matter of training our staff to be good technical writers, to, you know, look at the rules and for interpret the rules, and when documenting that, do it in a manner that's readable to the public and supportable. And the way we have our data system set up now, there is an internal data system, and then we have a limited amount of information that's available to our partners automatically. So that whole issue that you're talking about, making information easily accessible, but making sure that only that information that's supposed to be public is accessible. So we work closely with our IT department to ensure that.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Very informative. Thank you.
Chair Kilmaine, could I get one more question?
Well, I'm sorry. I didn't see you over there. Oh. I mean, I saw you, but I did not see you late.
Well, I might have been late in my hand-waving as you're turned away here. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I've got a curiosity question, because this particular issue has been jumping up at me in a variety of settings, so it's not aimed at this one particularly. But you talk about background checks in terms of pre-employment screening. Does that include drug testing?
Representative Cowan, Representative Tomei, members of the committee, no, it doesn't. We do a paper review of background. So if there's a conviction related to drug use, we would see that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good question.
Well, Chair Tomei, if I'm right, it's just cropped up in a whole variety of areas that I believe there are some limitations that are new to me that I'm still trying to do some research on, but it's an area that I think is not being done very often. Right. So I'm raising that for the committee to think about a little bit.
Yes, thank you. Did I miss anybody else? All right. Again, thank you very much. Good job. Update on Carley's Law, House Bill 3328, that we passed in 2007. Stacey Ayers, is that correct? Nikki Cerise, Cynthia Simpson, and Gretchen Bennett.
Chair Tomei and Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, I'm Mickey Cerise, Deputy Assistant Director for Children, Adults, and Families with the Department of Human Services, and we're here to give you an update on Carley's Law, and I'd like to start off with some brief comments, but the most important thing that I want to do this morning is to introduce you to Stacey Ayers, sitting to my left. And Stacey is our new Child Protective Services Program Manager in Central Office. So he replaces Una Swanson, who I think most of you know and most of you have worked with over the past couple of sessions. So we recognize a loss with Una, and also again with Stacey. I think you'd be very impressed with him. To begin with, we have updated this committee about two times on the implementation of Carley's Law since it was passed in June 27th of 07. And we've completed the rules. I think the last update we indicated we had temporary rules in place, and we have now permanent rules in place that went into effect in April of 2008. And we also have continued and completed the training for all staff, but that's an ongoing thing. It's not something that would end and then we would never pick that up again. So we're continuing to do some of those efforts. And we continue to get anecdotal information from the field regarding Carley's Law. And from my perspective, two things I've heard most often, and that is the child welfare workers that are actually working the law call this a good bill. They think that this has moved their practice a long way. And while there is still some confusion, because I think it is a new law and it has a lot of details to that law, the workers, I think, are doing a very good job in reporting and responding appropriately and according to the statute. So I'm going to turn this over to Stacey and let him give you some more detailed information on our update. Thank you.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Stacey Ayers, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for Children, Adults, and Families. And a little bit of an update about Carley's Law. We began training related to Carley's Law back in June, and June of 07 through March of 2008. Many of the trainings were in conjunction with the county multidisciplinary teams. There were approximately 7 trainings that were done in conjunction with them that were called the Carley's Day trainings. And I think that Ms. Stenson will be speaking to that a little bit as well. Part of the trainings were focused on the use of cameras, specifically the use of cameras and photography and how the pictures are being taken, specifically related to Carley's Law, and also the implementation and the interpretation of the statute. There are also a number of individual phone calls done with the Protective Services Program with local offices, local DHS offices in the state. There are monthly phone calls, and 5 of them, to talk about implementation, how things were going with the law, how workers were handling the workload, and how cases were going and whether there are any problems related with the law. There was also a training done in conjunction with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, which is law enforcement. And that was at their child abuse conference. It was in conjunction with law enforcement, or people attending that were law enforcement, attorneys, other MDT members, as well as child welfare. Currently, the numbers that we have related to, I've kind of broken this up into 3 sections and just talking about the training portion of it, and then talk about the cameras a little bit. Currently, we believe we're staffed, or we have numbers of about 1 to 1.2, so a camera for every 1.1 or 1.2 workers. It's about, if you're breaking down the numbers, it's about 247 cameras and about 305, there's a range of workers, but around 305 protective services workers who would be doing the investigations and would need the cameras. We've also factored in about 18 printers that we know that have been purchased, whether it be through the local multidisciplinary teams and the counties, or through the specific local offices. So these printers are specifically used for printing photo quality prints from the digital cameras. We also know that there are some instances where the MDTs have allocated money out of their individual budgets to purchase cameras and printers, and so it's real difficult for us to get a good idea of, with the number of MDTs that are in the state, it's difficult to get an idea of how many cameras or how many printers they've purchased. So there may be more than we know at this point. These are just the numbers that we were able to gather. As far as the Carley's Law certs go, that was a component of the statute. There have been 3 Carley's Law certs, critical incident response team cases, that occurred since the inception of this statute. And there have been a total of 6 certs in that same period of time. So half of the cert cases were Carley's Law cases. Generally speaking, we think that every one of our Child Protective Services staff have been trained in Carley's Law. And this is kind of an ongoing process. The formal process occurred in those period from the inception of the law up until about March. We continue to have consultation. We continue to work with staff as they come through, or as they're hired, new staff. We lose staff with turnover and things like that. So it's an ongoing process. At this point, I guess I would go ahead and open it up if you have questions of me. That's the, kind of the information I have at this point.
Nikki, is it appropriate that we have ask questions now, or do you want to wait until all the people have testified?
We can. We're flexible. Whatever the committee's preference.
Why don't we wait? Is that appropriate with everyone that we wait until everybody has testified? Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Services Division within the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here today to report to you on Carly's Law statistics that have been gathered from September 1st, 2007 through August 31st, 2008. And the statistics that we gathered were required by Carly's Law. We're required to come here and give you a report on the implementation, and I think you all hopefully by now have my testimony in front of you. One connection I want to make for you is that our office administers grants to victim service agencies, and one of those pots of money that we administer is a child abuse multidisciplinary intervention, or CAMI, account. And so we work very closely, we had been working very closely already with the multidisciplinary teams in all 36 counties. And so it was a natural fit for us to be gathering information on Carly's Law. I'm not going to go through each of the statistics here, but one caveat that I'll give when you're looking at these numbers is that because Carly's Law had an emergency clause that went into effect immediately, people were in the field were kind of scrambling to figure out not only how to procedurally implement the law, so what to do in the field and how that all works out, but then we came along and said, and we're going to ask you to keep statistics on things you've never tracked before. So I would ask you to treat these statistics as kind of a snapshot about how we're doing. I don't think it's the whole picture about how the law is being implemented. There are various ways that the different counties are collecting this data. Most often it's the in the counties that have an MDT coordinator, it's that person or the chair of the MDT who's kind of dogging their colleagues to get their information in. And then, of course, all of the different entities are tracking the information in different ways. So it's not necessarily a centralized and really uniform data tracking system. And we continue to try to educate our MDT folks about the easiest ways to track and give them tools and those kind of things so we can, as we move along in implementation of Carly's Law, I think those statistics will get better. I wanted to point out a couple of the statistics, though, on page 2 at the bottom, talks about law enforcement and DHS personnel making a reasonable effort to locate a DMP or designated medical professional, and after those reasonable efforts, if a DMP is not available within 48 hours, the child can be evaluated by an available physician. And so this is one of the areas where we are still needing to do some work. You'll see that 43, almost 44% of the kids were seen by someone other than the DMP. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't consult with the DMP after they were seen, this is an area that we need to work on because the general level of knowledge about child abuse within the medical community is not very high. It's not something they get training on as a general rule, and so we're working on that, and there will be continued work that we need to do. On page 3, I will also point out another lower statistic that we're working on, going to be working on. The very last statistic there, 47.3% of the cases involving suspicious physical injury that were staffed by an MDT, in 47% of those cases, the MDT actually saw the photos related to that case. And there are various reasons why that might not happen. One is just sheer coordination. Sometimes the officer, patrol officer, or DHS worker who actually took the pictures is not the person who sits on the MDT and may not even know when that meeting's happening, so it's just kind of that coordination. Sometimes the MDTs meet, you know, depending on the timing, may meet before, you know, everything can be processed and the pictures printed. So we will be working with MDTs to try to get that number up so that more pictures are available when the cases are staffed by the MDT. I should say, too, though, that I think many of these cases are being staffed by what you might call an executive committee of the MDT. When they can't get the whole group together, often in areas where they do have one of the 19 child abuse intervention centers in the state, they're kind of doing a huddle. Instead of the whole team looking at the pictures, you may have the DMP, law enforcement, DHS worker kind of conferring together instead of the whole entire team. So, again, these statistics aren't as foolproof as we'd like. In training and technical assistance, just to follow up what Nikki said, we've been doing a lot of training. DOJ has trained over 500 people, 500 multidisciplinary team members, which includes law enforcement, DAs and deputy DAs, DHS workers. So DHS workers may be hearing this information in a variety of settings, child advocacy center, or child intervention center personnel, folks at the Department of Ed or in schools, child care division. It just depends on the makeup of the MDTs, but we've been all over the state doing trainings, and we've done some in conjunction with DPSST, as Stacy and Mickey mentioned, and also in conjunction with DHS. So we've been trying to partner at every available opportunity to get information out there to the MDTs, to law enforcement, DHS workers about the parameters of the law, forensic photography techniques, you know, how to handle the photos when you get them, all of those kind of things. So clearly we still have work to do in the training area, but as my colleague said, it's an ongoing process. We continue to try to refine that, make it available. One of the things that DOJ did that wasn't prescribed by the bill that we saw a need for, so we went ahead and moved forward, was we convened a small medical work group to try to look at the issues around training for family practice physicians, primary physicians, pediatricians, and that work group wanted to increase awareness amongst their colleagues about the requirements of the bill, provide additional child abuse training, and to provide existing designated medical professionals with support and resources so we can avoid having those folks turn over once we get them trained in the counties. And I'm happy to say that one of the projects of that medical work group will be coming very soon, be available, an online training that will be a 60 to 90 minute module for primary care providers on child abuse, the Oregon law, and the requirements of Carley's law. So it will be something that physicians can go online to access. It will be on our website. We'll hopefully have it available on other websites. The Legacy Health System is offering this training, and medical providers will get a 1.5 continuing medical education credit also. So that will be up November 1st, and we will also be trying to do some PR with giving some tools to the MDTs to get out to their medical community to get that information. A couple issues from the field that I wanted to highlight that came about as we were working with all of our MDT partners on implementation of this law, and one of them is a strain that's been put on those 19 child abuse intervention centers throughout the state. Those centers were set up primarily to do sexual abuse screenings with kids, and those are, if you're not familiar with the world of child abuse screening, I'll just give you an encapsulated description. Those centers are set up to do non-acute interviews and exams, and that means that they're often a period of time after the abuse has occurred. And as is typical with sexual abuse, sometimes the disclosure comes a long time after the actual event. So There are, of course, acute cases. Those often go to the emergency room and have a medical forensic kit taken, but that is not the majority of cases that the intervention centers see. In fact, most of them are not set up to do acute exams. So they had a pattern and practice of seeing kids on a schedule. You know, the report comes in from DHS, law enforcement, or some other partner or a parent, and the center then schedules the interview and exam at the same time. It's very extensive. They spend a lot of time with the families. They also do wraparound services, information and referral, help them fill crime victims compensation forms, those kind of things. So that was kind of their practice. Carlisbaugh came along, and what we've seen now is a shift in the context of their clients. So they've gone from planned, non-acute, scheduled interviews and exams to needing to have capacity for unplanned, acute, physical abuse cases. And that is a real paradigm shift for programs, and I'll let Gretchen talk about that a little bit more. But I just wanted to point that out for you, and that is having a fiscal impact on the centers that really no one expected. It was very hard to predict how this would play out. So it is having a fiscal impact on the centers. The best statistics I can give you right now is about almost an 18% increase in the number of assessments that they're doing, that sexual abuse and physical abuse. The years prior to Carlisbaugh, we were kind of seeing a steady number of sex abuse exams. So to have an almost 18% increase, I think, can be partially attributed anyway to Carlisbaugh implementation. We have talked with Representative Gelser about this next point. There's confusion in the field about the term suspicious physical injury, what that means, what is suspicious, what is reasonable suspicion, and part of that is a training issue. We need to continue to train law enforcement and DHS and how to interpret those, and I think there may be some more room to tighten up that language in this next session. This next issue, I don't know that we've addressed it. I think we need to put it out there. When there's lack of cooperation from parents, law enforcement and child abuse personnel out there in the field, they see a suspicious physical injury and they say this child needs to be seen by a doctor. And for whatever reason, there may not be enough evidence to actually take the child into custody. What happens then? It isn't happening a lot. I think many times parents are welcoming the chance for their child to see a physician. But law enforcement and DHS then are in a real tight spot. If they don't have authority to take custody of the child, they cannot, as the law prescribes, ensure that the child is seen by a medical professional in 48 hours. And I think that, you know, leaves them open to some liability if something happens to that child and they were not able to ensure that they were seen. And then again, my final point is we need to increase the basic child abuse training in the medical field so that all of our medical providers, at least those that are frequently seeing children, family practice, pediatricians, primary care providers, have, of course, we don't want them to be experts in child abuse, but frankly, we want them to know what they don't know. So to know enough about child abuse to say this child needs to be seen, definitely needs to be seen at the Child Abuse Intervention Center, or I need to consult with someone who's an expert in child abuse. So that's the training that we're working on and hoping to spread further in the state.
Thank you. I know we have questions, and I'm hoping that, and thank you for your patience, committee, and at the end we'll have questions.
Sure.
Thank you.
You betcha. Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Gretchen Bennett, and I'm the executive director at Liberty House, a child abuse assessment center in Marion County and also serving children in Polk County. And we have the doctor on staff who's the DMP for the area. Later today, I get to go watch my son Jack run in the kindergarten jogathon, and he's healthy and ready to run in that. In stark contrast, yesterday at work, a meeting that we had was quickly interrupted with a telephone call with a quote-unquote Carly's case, where a kindergarten boy presented at school with pretty extensive bruising, and the caseworker was at the school and wanted to consult with the DMP about what might be an appropriate medical course of action. And thank you to the Oregon Legislature for that leadership in making that type of call and connection with a medical provider and medical professional a routine rather than more of an exception a couple of years ago. As Child Abuse Partners in the Valley implement Carly's Law, we identify successes and we also identify challenges, and I've provided written testimony and won't go into all of that, but I do want to report to you that we see more physical exams happening in a more timely fashion. We see an increase in the quality of the photographs that are taken and in the appropriateness of the timing of those photographs taken, which is absolutely essential in physical abuse cases. To be able to understand the injury before those injuries start to heal is absolutely essential to protect that child's future safety. Case reviews and discussions related to Carly's Law, the collaboration, I think, has also improved in our county, and I hear examples of that statewide. The intersection between the different systems and the coordination will result in the best outcomes for children. There are also important challenges that we face, and I think it's self-evident that we can't afford to miss injuries. Carly's case is a very tragic, fatal example in point, and we have seen examples in our community where the simple initial recognition of the injury as possible child abuse sends that child back home into the arms of potential abusers, and then you see worse outcomes later. And that's what we're working hard to avoid, and what I think is an ongoing training and technical assistance challenges for people in the field. So whether you're a nurse in the middle of the night in the emergency room or a fairly new patrol officer out on patrol in the rural county, that you can recognize some potential concerns with the injury and perhaps that the story isn't matching up and be able to kick Carly's Law into place is an important ongoing challenge for this work. We have one designated medical provider in Marion County, and I'll assert that we're one of the largest counties in the state, and that's inadequate. We've been running a national, local, regional recruitment process since the beginning of Carly's Law to try to add to the depth of our team to be able to see more children, but we've been unsuccessful in adding to the examination team. And we'll be able to see more children physically at our center and provide more DMP examinations when we can deepen our team. That's a challenge that we face at Liberty House here in Salem. And in our county, as a result, the DMP relies heavily on other medical providers and does quite a bit of triage and consultation. We have been able to identify high-risk injuries and situations, and I'll leave you with just one thing that just always is in our hearts and what we are appreciative of the law around, which is very early after the implementation, there was a young girl who presented with extensive bruising of different shades and colors and at different parts of her body. And we believe that it was the implementation of Carly's Law and the requirements that set up, which triggered conversations which improved that child's safety and outcomes for her. And so I would never comment on the specific details around a child's confidentiality, but would rather just offer to you how absolutely heartwarming it is to realize that prior to the law, that child may not have connected to the medical services and the safety, the investigation that child may have needed. So I'll leave you with that thought.
Thank you so much, and I know we have lots of questions. I'll start with Representative Kotek.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my first question is to Gretchen. Why do you think you've been unsuccessful in expanding the number of DMPs, designated medical professionals, in your county? What's the barrier, you know?
Well, thanks for asking, and I think they're varied. We'd like to think we're nice people to work with, but we're fearful that the simple issue of child abuse and the difficulties of it is hard. To see child abuse once every so often in a normal course of practice as compared to every day in and day out, is a challenge for some. There's myths out there that we would spend all day in court, and we just simply don't do that because we do a great job up front of documenting information. I think around the state pay and the financial barrier can be an issue, whether it's repayment of student loans or incentives to jump into this type of hard work if the pay on average statewide is under what someone might make in primary practice. So those are things that I would generally cite.
Thank you. Follow up?
And this is a broader question. I don't know if DOJ would be the right, but one of the things that came up in the last full session was the fact that even though docs are mandatory reporters. They don't have any requirement. I see you were presenting a CME at 1.5 CME for people to get trained, and I don't know if I would recommend that level of training per se, but the fact that as designated reporters, doctors and other physicians in the states don't even have to take some kind of regular training on the issue is problematic. And I didn't know if nurses, I don't know of the, all the medical professionals who has to take some kind of continuing ed on this topic and who doesn't, but I know that there is no CME requirement on this topic. So that might be something we want to explore. I don't know if anyone has a comment on that, but.
Pat Lipson, COTEC members of the committee. I think that's something to have convening conversation with the medical community about. I know that all of the MDTs statewide do child abuse protocol trainings where they invite all kinds of community partners, law enforcement, DHS, child care workers, school personnel, and medical providers to give them information about mandatory reporting. Historically, and I'll let Gretchen comment on this if she has any other information, but historically, my understanding is it's very difficult to get the medical community to any kind of training on child abuse. It's just not very exciting for them for whatever reason, and so it's part of the work that we need to continue to do, whether it's about mandatory reporting or basics of child abuse. Or I know there have been several forums that were created just for child abuse. I think one was here in Salem, even just for medical providers, and have had very sparse participation by medical personnel.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I follow up on that issue for a moment? I think one of the goals of Carley's Law was that hopefully by reaching out into the community and urging people to become designated medical providers, that would enhance the understanding in the community and urge people to step up to the plate and get more training. And there have been a lot of barriers to having that happen. But I think that one of the things that's excited me is how eager the Department of Justice and the Department of Human Services and the assessment centers have been to step up to the plate to enhance those opportunities. And if you look into the testimony that the Department of Justice provided about some of those trainings, the idea of this continuing medical education being provided, that's really exciting when, you know, there's not a law, there's not a mandate for somebody to have created that, but it came up from people collaborating. Another discussion that I had, I sat down with Care Oregon and Cares Northwest, and Care Oregon now has a nonprofit, and they had talked about their willingness to pay stipends to physicians that would be willing to attend trainings, to both to pay the cost of their being away and an actual stipend to go, and Cares Northwest offered to step up and provide that training as well to the physicians. One of the other things that I just wanted to share for the committee's consideration, over the course of the past year, I've had the chance to go and visit with different child abuse assessment centers around the state and talk with teams in rural areas and urban areas about the challenges that they were facing, and the access to trained medical providers clearly has been the biggest barrier. And so as a result of those conversations, some of the legislation that's going to be proposed in 09 to address that includes the hiring or the creation of two itinerant designated medical professionals that would be housed at the Department of Justice, and they would be available to do two things: travel to both urban or rural centers who have an influx of cases. And that's the thing, child abuse doesn't happen on a schedule, and so even Clackamas Children's Center, for example, might have 3 Carley cases in a week and then not have any for a month. They need help that 1 week, but hiring a whole new FTE isn't sustainable. So these itinerant folks would be able to go and fill in at a place like Clackamas County or Multnomah County or Liberty House, but they'd also be available to go out to Gilliam or Baker or more rural parts of the state that don't have those providers. And then they'd also be available to provide those reviews, the record reviews. And that's been a problem for the assessment centers, because even though folks are compensated for providing the exams, we don't have a compensation mechanism for when the assessment centers then end up doing all these file reviews when other physicians are doing them. And these itinerant folks could do that. And then to couple with that, to take some of that load off, we were looking at establishing some tax credits to encourage physicians in local communities, up to 2 in each community, to be approved by the county multidisciplinary disciplinary team to attend some of these trainings so that they were qualified to do that, that would agree to do 8 to 12 CARLI exams over the course of a year. And the intent behind that tax credit is what some of the physicians are saying is if they have to go testify in court, they end up sitting in court all day or for 2 days, and they're not being reimbursed for that period of time, and their medical practice financially can't weather that blow. So the intent of the tax credit would be to help relieve some of that financial pressure and also to relieve the pressure off of the assessment centers, and it would increase the knowledge in the community for the physicians that were doing that. And then I had a question for you, Stacey. You had mentioned the critical incident response team, that there had been three that were CARLI related. So that CARLI only triggers for the certs when there's a death.
Correct.
So that was three child
fatalities known to the agency, and that would trigger by statute the CARLI saw fatality cert.
Okay.
So.
Great. Thanks.
Representative Maurer.
Since when?
Thanks, Madam Chair.
I'm going to stop just a second. Rex, and go in. Ask your question.
Since when? The fatalities since what date?
Okay.
Representative Gillen and Chair Tomei, members of the committee, that is from June of 2007, since the inception of the law, when it was implemented or enacted. So there have been
that one we went into effect? 2007. June 2007. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Maurer, sorry to interrupt you.
Well, Madam Chair, since you like Representative Gillen better than...
We all do.
Thank you.
We'll talk about that offline.
I'll have to Google it on my internet.
It's okay, Ron. I'm here for you.
Well, thanks. Hey, Representative Kotek asked one question about medical providers or the DMP and why you can't. I'm not sure we're ever going to get over that hump. I don't think you can pay people enough to do some of this work, which is challenging at best. But my question is the concern about the liability issue for non-cooperative parents. I mean, I guess if the DHS and law enforcement are doing everything they can and documenting that they've done everything they can, and the law is preventing them from going that next step, then I'm not quite sure there's going to be liability there as long as they're doing what they need to do. And so you either look at changing the law or you accept the fact that there are limits to what you can do. And I just, using the liability argument, I think is not very helpful in the argument.
Was there a question in there?
There isn't. That was a comment. No, it was purely a comment.
Okay.
Sorry.
Fine. Thank you. Representative Callan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will probably make a comment also, but I will get to some questions at the end of my comment, I promise. Very shortly after the implementation of CARLI's law, the House Rural Policy Committee, as we had planned to do, went on a rural tour of Umatilla, Union, Baker, Grant, and Harney counties. Just leaving folks in those rural communities on the eastern side of the state an opportunity to ask us questions and voice some of their general issues. And at the very first stop, one of the very first things we heard were the challenges of the implementation of CARLI's law to those communities. It was actually in relationship to some of the questions that I tried to raise as we were discussing this, you know, those things about the impact that, quote, no one expected. So I wasn't surprised to hear it. Because of my rural focus, I understand how difficult it is to do the same things that you're challenged to do in Marion County, and as you're unsuccessful in recruiting a second physician to be part of this team, imagine how difficult it is to recruit someone who is willing to do that on the eastern side of the state. And I think that the one thing that we are overlooking here as we talk about all of the unwillingness of medical providers to get the training and that it's not very exciting and that it's difficult work, is that we are not adequately addressing the severe shortage of family practice and primary care providers throughout our state. That same rural policy committee just got back from another three-day tour of southeastern and southern and southwestern Oregon, where we talked to, 12 or 13 rural health care providers. That tour was specifically aimed at health care. And the continuing challenges of recruiting people to provide basic medical care in those communities. At the same time, the state is mandating extra challenges. So I'm not saying that this is a bad thing to do in any way, shape, or form. I care as much about children as the next, but we have to recognize the basic shortage of providers in our communities, and particularly our rural communities. And please recognize what physicians are challenged with in meeting their day-to-day responsibilities in their practices. And not just suggesting that they're uninterested in doing some of this kind of work. So I guess my questions aimed at whomever I'm going to list them. I'd like you to address a little bit about how seriously we are looking at that chronic provider shortage, especially in rural areas. And I know there was some talk about if only we could broaden these requirements and enough to allow perhaps RNs with specialty training, or I'm not sure exactly in terms of the medical provider designation, whether that includes nurse practitioners, physician assistants. I believe it does. I don't know if you've gone as far as to include registered nurses when there is not someone else available, but there were a number of places who said there were individuals willing to step up to the plate and get that training if the medical provider designee was not available. I am a little bit curious about what the post-exam requirements are for the DMP, how much time that individual is likely then to spend in court, and I did hear the suggestion that we may be looking at some tax credits to relieve some of that financial pressure. I do know that when providers' compensation in their clinic practice is based on RVUs or relative value units, then taking a full day out of the practice to be in court is a difficult financial challenge that will be hard pressed to overcome with a tax credit. And so I guess those are my basic questions. I appreciate the fact that we'll be looking at the possibility of hiring some sort of an itinerant medical professional. It'll be a challenge to travel to Pendleton when we have the influx and do it within 48 hours, or Harney County or Melier County, but we really do need to address those things. So I guess those are the two kinds of issues that I'm interested in finding out more about, is whether we're expanding that availability to other professional healthcare professionals if the physicians aren't available, and what the court requirement time is in follow-up. And finally, to the caution that if we look at some interpretation to tighten the language during the next session and the interpretation of the law, that I really will be looking at a fiscal impact of doing that.
So, thank you, Representative.
Representative Cowan and members of the committee, I don't mean to jump in for the two. You guys may also have comments, but just to, I was, before the conversation shifted about some of the barriers for doctors attending training, your very accurate point about scarcity is one that I was going to make. I think that's the top barrier that we certainly hear and are aware of the statistics. I think that Salem area alone is short 11 primary care family physicians, and that's an important statistic that I know that we share statewide. I have the opportunity to work face-to-face on a quarterly basis with the centers from rural and eastern Oregon and hear firsthand about some of the challenges that they face with individual children. And what I think my colleagues are remain very committed to is ensuring that the medical professional that is with that child has the expertise and the credential both to effectively evaluate that child's injuries, which are subtle and require a level of expertise and training to do well, and also the credentials to be able to stand up in court. And that's an essential element of being able to make a diagnosis in a medical situation to affect the future treatment outcome and also be influential in court process. So that's an essential element of looking at how to meet the needs. I think there's been a lot of exciting creative recruitment ideas locally as our community wraps around this need, different types of donations that come in to help us ensure that we have the medical help that we need. Post-exam requirements really vary. There can be a lot of time spent in follow-up, maybe reviewing of x-rays or other medical records and being on the telephone with other medical providers, consulting about care. Documentation at the time can reduce time spent in court in the future. And so it's by no means our experience that our DMP will go and spend all day in court. We have a great ability to work closely with local prosecutors to ensure that the time spent in court is well spent and focused, and we come and testify and leave, and by no means need to testify on every case we work on. So I guess those are just a couple of comments I'd offer.
Representative Callen, members of the committee, I share a lot of Gretchen's views, and I don't have a good answer for how to increase the number of physicians statewide. Certainly, in my testimony where it talks about those counties that don't have DMPs, most of them are the very rural ones, and it is not for lack of trying. They are trying very hard to get DMPs in their counties, whether it's a nurse practitioner or a doctor. And in some of those counties don't even have a medical provider, period, in their county. So, you know, people have to go out of county for all kinds of treatment. So certainly that is a problem, and I did not mean to be disrespectful in any way about the burdens on medical providers. Simply wanting to point out that if our goal is to make sure that children are not falling through the cracks when they've been physically abused, then we've got to get good training to all of our doctors, as I was trying to say. But it certainly is an issue. We are working with those counties that don't have DMPs to try to brainstorm how to recruit more folks. One of the other things that we've done recently that may help a bit is that we received some money through our office for regional service providers. We had three, historically had three, and now we have five, and one of those is on the eastern side at Mount Emily Safe Center. So those regional service providers are responsible for kind of their constituent counties, and they are supposed to be providing technical assistance and training to those counties on a variety of issues. And certainly if they were unable to locate a DMP, I think they would be calling their regional service provider and saying, help me, do you have a county or a doctor that we could send this child to? So hopefully access on the eastern side will improve a bit with Mount Emily as a regional service provider.
Thank you.
Very quickly. I appreciate those efforts. I'm not sure exactly where Mount Emily Safe Center is, but I know where Mount Emily is, so I've got a pretty good idea that it's up in the northeastern corner, which is still a full drive from Nissa or Baker City or halfway. I spent some time over there. So I'm still going to encourage us to continue to look at expanding the training opportunities to other professionals. I understand criteria that will hold up in court, but the one comment I want to add to it is let's also look at the impact on the child who is in a difficult situation, who is then forced to travel. And that was the message that we were hearing very clearly, and I think I just have an obligation to bring that message back, that the professionals in the area were disturbed because if they didn't have the designated medical provider at hand, then they, from in this case it was in Pendleton, would haul the child to Bend. And our whole purpose in developing the child centers particularly aimed at sexual abuse was to try to provide a place that children could come and everything would be done in a safe and comfortable area, and it would prevent them from having to be taken from one place to another. So I just don't want to disrupt that focus on the child, that as much as we can possibly provide at home is the way to ease the burden that the child is already facing.
Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thank you, Representative Cowan. And we talked about those last fall. And I wonder a little bit, with the training that's happened around Carly's Law and the provisions of the law, some of that has changed, because there are a lot of off-ramps in the bill that don't actually require the child to move or to be examined by that designated medical professional. And actually, Bob Smith, who was at the Kids Center in Bend, had done a lot of work before his recent retirement, which is a real loss to the state of Oregon. He just really did a great job over there looking at how to use telemedicine, how to better ease the safe electronic transfer of records and photographs so that a child is not moving from their community in order to be physically seen by another physician. And I think that's part of the point of the idea of that itinerant person. You wouldn't always need that person to go all the way out to Harney County or out to NISA to physically see the child. Some of this could be accomplished by just a general physician that's there doing an exam, and then the follow-up, the consultation is done when the records and the photographs are sent to that person. So that's a way to relieve that and cut down on the transportation and focus on the kid. We don't want them driving hours away. We want to be as sensitive to them as possible.
Okay.
And I think the one other piece I did follow up with some of the assessment centers about the idea of the registered nurse. In the law right now, the designated medical provider includes physicians, physician's assistants, and nurse practitioners. And there was some concern from some of the medical directors of the assessment centers that was shared with me about expanding that to registered nurses just because of the level of medical training that goes there, and hoping instead to be able to improve the ease of which that consultation could happen from other providers.
Representative Kotick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had the question about the DMPs and expanding to RNs, but what's the breakdown now of the DMPs, physicians, PAs, advanced nurse practitioners? Do we know? I'm just curious.
Representative Kotick, members of the committee, I don't know.
Okay.
And maybe you can get that information.
I can try to find out for you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, any last questions? I just want to point out, this has only been in effect, 15 or 16 months. I think we've come a long ways. You've come a long ways in that time. And I'm sure there's a lot more work to do in order to make sure that this is the law that we want it to be, covering all the children in Oregon and certainly in the most rural areas. But we've come a long ways, and I think congratulations to you and to all of us in the state. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. May I have a follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you. And I heartily agree with that. I had a call from a constituent a couple days ago who expressed some concerns about a case that might have fallen through the cracks at CARES Northwest. We've gotten an address, but I think everyone is feeling quite the stress at the assessment centers. Is the department going to be asking for a readjustment in criminal fines and assessments to deal with some of the issues at the CAMI centers?
Representative Kotick, members of the committee, we actually are not. At the time that we had to put our policy packages in, we did not have good data about fiscal impacts on centers, so it was kind of a timing issue. And okay. In this economic climate, things aren't looking really good. So we don't formally have one in at this time. We do have a policy package to allow us to our office to get some more money to pay for medical assessments. We have a pot of money that comes to us, and when assessments are done on children at centers that follow an interview and an exam and wraparound services as prescribed by the CAMI law, and then a crime is not deemed to have occurred, we can pay for those assessments through that medical assessment fund. We are going to be running out of funds in about January, and we'll be using some of our own funds to fill that gap. But essentially, that's money that goes back to the centers then for those assessments. We also have, hopefully we'll be part of the Carly Saw legislation that will allow us to pay for some of those
exams that take place somewhere other than an assessment center, so they don't meet the CAMI law requirement, and they're being done at ERs or family practice. And if a crime has not occurred, then we can't pay the crime victim's compensation. It wasn't done at a center, so we can't pay for our medical assessment. Those parents are getting those bills for those medical exams, and so we're hoping to be able to tweak the law a little bit so that we can pay to some extent on those.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Good job. Committee, Senator Lori Montes Anderson is here, and she has a bill she would like us to consider, the committee bill. I'm going to allow her to come up now and talk about her committee bill, and then we can vote on committee bills at the end of our meeting this morning. So welcome, Senator. Welcome to the upper chamber.
Could I also invite Stephanie?
Absolutely.
Good morning. I'm Senator Lori Montes Anderson, and there's only 13 more days left of the campaign season, so that will be very, very nice and refreshing to get over this part so we can start doing the business at hand for Oregon. I'm here. Well, before I jump into this, I think it's important for the last people who were testify. We have an interim committee on reimbursement for telemedicine, and we are considering, because rural areas are use the medical services from the metropolitan areas, we're now looking at how to reimburse so that this video and teleconferencing, et cetera, that you don't have to bring the child or the patient to the metropolitan area. And so we are looking, and there will be a bill. Actually, it's a committee bill that went through my committee on reimbursement for telehealth. And I want to make sure that the people that testified, make sure that that will take in their needs also.
Great.
With that, I'd like to move in. We have a wonderful Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse program, and Representative Cowan and I are the representatives from the legislature to that. And believe me, it's exhausting to be a part of that program, because they meet, I swear, more than the legislature does. But they are doing very good work, and there were some issues that they wanted to present, but we didn't meet the deadline. My meeting this month was at the beginning of the month, and we wanted to introduce this as a committee bill. And with that, I would like to have Stephanie Pump go over a little bit about what this actually does.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Stephanie Suarez Pump, Chair of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. And I have to say I'm proud to serve with Representative Cowan and Senator Montes Anderson. We were thrilled when both of them were appointed, and we're even more thrilled that they actually attend and participate and are a part of the council. And it's enriched us, so I wanted to say thank you to them. The council's job is enormous. We are responsible for essentially determining the state of the state, if you will, on the situation economically and socially with substance abuse in the state of Oregon, both alcohol and other drugs. We have currently 11 state agencies named in our legislation who are required to update the council on a biennial basis. We are finding ourselves, because I should say their missions somehow relate to alcohol and other drugs, we are finding ourselves involved with an additional 8 state agencies whose missions also in some way relate to this area of service to the people of Oregon. Our charge covers prevention, treatment, and recovery services, and we are required to report to the governor and the legislature every biennium. Many of you are familiar with our domino effect report that was issued last biennium. Our new domino effect, if it's not broke, don't fix it, right, which kept the name. domino effect two has been given to the governor and will be released to the members and the public after the election. One of the things that we have discovered in carrying out our charge is that we need to update our legislation, which hasn't happened in about 15 years. So we've asked for a name change. We've asked for our membership numbers to be expanded from 11 to 15 so we can spread the work around a little bit more. And we've asked that a number of state agencies be added to our charge. And that is the essence of the submission to you today. There's one correction that when we deal with it formally, we will come back to you with, and that is that the name, the word was supposed to be use, not abuse, because our charge spans more than just the abusive areas. It also goes into the economic and social consequences of use, period.
So the name change really should read, we wanted to change it to Governor's Council on Substance Use Disorders.
Okay. All right. And colleagues, we don't have, I think it's a very big bill, right?
It's a big 45 pages.
Yes, mm-hmm. Right. So we don't have to read every page.
We don't?
No, actually, you have to read pages 1, 3, and...
Finance today, you're going to have to read.
It's all in bold that we need to read.
And five, pages 1, 3, and 5.
Okay, 1, 3, and 5. Thank you.
Yep, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stephanie, I'm looking at the bill. I'm just curious, what was your connection of plugging in the Marine Board and Criminal Justice Commission to it?
The Marine Board actually asked us to include them. Boating under the influence has become a huge problem, and they've done an incredible job dealing with the issues. The Criminal Justice Commission, we work with them on a regular basis. The drug courts, their work touches 80% of their population is involved with alcohol or other drugs, so it's a natural fit.
And I think we need to look at, since we passed the parity bill, mental health parity bill, this is one way so that we don't have all these separate silos. It's trying to bring together so that we don't have these separate entities dealing with the same issue, because they really do cross over.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? We're not going to vote. We'll vote on this after the at the end of our meeting. So great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Now we're moving to the Governor's Association, the Casey Agreement on Foster Care, with Erin Kelly Seal, Mickey Lansing, and Ben DeHaan. Welcome. I think, Dr. DeHaan, this is your first time in front of our committee?
It is.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I'm the Interim Director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division in the Department of Human Services. We're here today because in September, when I had the opportunity to present to you all, I mentioned that we were working very hard on an exciting opportunity for Oregon to benefit Oregon's foster care, kids that are in foster care, and our child welfare system, and that's what we're here to give you more detail on today. We call it the Casey Agreement in shorthand, and so you'll probably hear us refer to that. Just to refresh your memory for some context, on average, every month in Oregon, there are about 9,000 children who are in foster care. And on any given, and in 2007, excuse me, over 15,000 Oregon children spent at least one day in foster care. Oregon happens to place more children in foster care, in other words, remove more children from their home, than many states in the country. And so looking closely at our data, we began discussion about setting some goals for ourselves and our system to safely reduce the number of children who are in foster care in Oregon. That means not removing children from their families when it is safe to keep them there, providing more supports for families on the front end. It means keeping children in foster care for shorter periods of time, getting them home or into another permanent safe placement when that is possible. And it means when they can't safely go home, that we as quickly as possible identify an alternative permanent resource for them so that they can be with someone who will care for them on a permanent basis for a longer period of time. We must absolutely, as a state, not accept foster care as a permanent option for our children. We must keep in mind that that our foster care system is designed to be a temporary safe haven for our kids. In September, I reported on the fact that we were setting some specific goals for ourselves, and it's very exciting to me to be sitting here with the Commission on Children and Families and with Dr. DeHaan, who is on contract with both DHS and the Commission, as we worked together to bring some additional resource from KC Family Programs to Oregon to help move us toward our goals in this area more quickly. I want to emphasize, in these difficult economic times and knowing that many of you have before now spent a lot of time giving policy direction to the agency around our foster care system, that this investment by KC is moving us in a direction that we already were heading, that it is really about getting us there more quickly and taking us where we already were being directed to go by you and by our data and by our kids and families, quite frankly. So with that, I'd like to ask, Nikki's going to give a quick overview of the history. She was part of the beginning of the conversation along with Brian Johnston, who preceded me, so that you can understand really where all this came from. And then Dr. DeHaan's going to review some of the specifics of what we're putting together, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the outcomes that we're hoping to achieve together with you and with this partnership.
Thank you, Erin. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I am the director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. As all of you know, the commission system has a primary role of 36 local county commissions on children and families, looking at their community, identifying community resources, strengths, needs, and gaps, and then mobilizing communities around those particular issues that they believe they can make an impact upon. They then send that information to the state, whereupon the state commission, as a policy body's role, is to take those priorities from local commissions and try to say or do whatever it is that needs to be done in order to address that particular issue. In January of 2006, 36 counties submitted an updated plan. 34 out of those plans indicated that child abuse and neglect prevention was a top priority. And one of the biggest issues was that our child abuse rate had gone up and our out-of-home placement rate for children had gone up. And what could we do about mobilizing communities around more foster care homes? So the State Commission looked at that issue. We asked Dr. Catherine Kahn from the Child Welfare Partnership at PSU to write us an issue brief outlining what the issues really are around the out-of-home placement rate and what could we do about foster care. And what she said to us is, we are never going to build ourselves out of this problem. And it's really not about additional foster care homes. The real issue is, how do you keep kids safe in their own home? But if you can't keep them safe, how do you place them with what we call safe kith or kin? Kith being adults who played a meaningful role in that child's life, maybe not a relative, but someone who they have a relationship with, or a relative. And we're talking about not just grandparents, we're talking about aunts, uncles, cousins. Whatever family member could be a resource for that particular child. So we invited Ramona Foley to present to the State Commission. We invited a man by the name of Kevin Campbell, not to be confused with Oregon's two Kevin Campbells. But his specialty is, in fact, a computer-based system that looks for relatives. When a child comes into care, that computer, you can put in the name of the mother, the parent, etc., and then find relatives for that particular child. We asked counties to respond to us who would be interested in creating teams at the county level to support the Department of Human Services, because remember, their role and their job, their responsibility is to place those children, but it's the community's responsibility to support them in the work that they do and help to mobilize community resources. We had 14 counties respond to that request. We have those 14 teams trained in how is it that they can search for a safe relative to either connect a child with or place a child with. And just for a little bit of data, what you need to know is what Kevin Campbell has found in his trainings around the U.S. is that 50% of these children are connected with a relative. Only 25% are placed with a relative. So it's not always about returning that child to their family, their nuclear family. It is about ensuring that those children have a connection to someone that they can continue a relationship with. So based upon these 14 county teams starting to try and do this work and support Department of Human Services and mobilize community resources, we of course quickly understood that we needed additional resources. I've known Ben DeHaan for about 20 years and knew that he was with Casey Family Programs, had an opportunity to talk with him, invited him to come to Oregon and start to talk about how could Casey Family Programs work with us in the state of Oregon to start to address this particular issue. So we did that almost a year ago. In fact, it was a year ago. And we started looking at the issue of relative placement, but also understood that it was a much broader issue. And so we then worked with the Department of the Human Services, started with Brian Johnston, and said, how could we, the commission system, help you in what you need to do in terms of your working with our most vulnerable children, and is there a partnership that we could develop? So based upon that, we did, and I now introduce you to Dr. Ben DeHaan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Benjamin DeHaan. I'm a private consultant working with children and families and with the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. I should probably tell you I am new to this committee with this group, but I have been here wearing a number of hats over the years. I worked for what was Children's Services Division, the Public Child Welfare Agency, for almost 20 years, and I was also the Deputy Director and the Interim Director for the Oregon Department of Corrections for 8 years. I've had two academic appointments at Portland State University, and I'm currently the Chair of the Board of Trustees for the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon. So I am, I make my home in the state of Washington now, but I'm frequently back and forth, so I've got a long history with the state of Oregon. Mickey mentioned to you that I was with Casey Family Programs. For about the last 5 years, I've been working on the national level for those years with Casey, working with child welfare systems across the country and handling their work in Congress. Doing a lot of their public policy work was very gratifying, there's no doubt about that, but flying to Washington, D.C. every week is not. So I'm back here doing work in a number of West Coast states and also here in Oregon. What I'll do today, you've heard some of the details already. I'll quickly walk through a document with you, and then if you have questions, feel free to ask them. The you know Casey Family Programs, I'm sure. They're based in Seattle, but there are a number of Casey cousins that often get confused with Casey Family Programs. There's Marguerite, there's Annie E., there's Casey I Institute. They originally all came from UPS, and we're working with Casey Family Programs. They're an operating foundation, and they're focused on foster care, improving foster care, and also reducing the need for foster care. They have some pretty ambitious goals for America, and they want to reduce foster care by 50% across the country. Well, as Aaron told you, we have there's a strategic alignment of their goals and our goals for the state of Oregon. So we've been working on putting this partnership together for about a year, and it kicked off October 1st. Everyone, first thing, say, well, how much money are we going to get? I mean, that's usually the bottom line when you're working with the foundation. And I have to equivocate a little bit. We have a three-year plan, and it's roughly about between $2.7 and $3 million. That was negotiated before the crash of the stock market, and most of the resources from Casey Family Programs comes from equities. Now, I anticipate that we're going to have a long relationship, but I just want to let you know that we're not giving you specific numbers today because that's going to be variable. So that's also unmatched money, which is something that we should consider. If we're talking about $3 million of philanthropic donations to the state, there are ways that we need to think about it strategically. 4E is potentially a matching source for some of this money. And in our discussions about this, there may even be some money in the commission's budget that is unmatched as well. So the numbers we're talking about here is money directly from the foundation. It doesn't include any potential matching opportunities that we'll think about. Four basic strategies. You've probably heard a great deal about the Oregon safety model. Every state that I've worked with in the last 5 years has a model that they want to move throughout their system. Everybody agrees it's a very good idea. And this framework in this state holds great potential for not only reducing foster care, but also reducing variation across service locations, a number of other practice improvements. But we see it as a very important vehicle to reduce foster care as well. And I should say, reduce foster care safely. Everything that we're talking about here is keeping kids out of the system only within the context of safety. That's the primary concern. The next strategy is all around disparate outcomes for children and families of color in this system. The state of Oregon is not unique in that it has a disproportionate number of ethnic minorities in the system. What we need to do is to sort out exactly why that's the case and develop some very clear strategies for fixing it. We're talking about Latino families, African American families, Native American community, and we are going to set some goals in 2009 around disproportionality indexes, but the first part of the work really has to be a drill down to sort out in the key decision points exactly what these effects are and what are the factors contributing to it. You heard a little bit already from Mickey about our third strategy, and that's increasing relative placements. It's inherently good, from my perspective, and I understand that there are different points of view, it's inherently a good thing to place children with relatives or people that they know. The whole point of this effort is not to give people blood tests to test whether or not they're actual true relatives. I think Mickey used the term KIF. What we're really trying to do here is to reduce the number of times a child wakes up in somebody else's house and they don't know them. And that's the point. So a lot of the relative placement discussion really gets moved towards the idea of technique and what a relative is and how do we pay them. Those are all important issues, but the most important issue is the strength and relationship of the bond between those caregivers and the child. That's what we're talking about. And our fourth strategy is pretty boring, but important. It's all about how you implement the first three. It's about data. It's about increasing the agency's ability to work cross systems. It takes money to coordinate. It takes, and I heard from some of the earlier presentations here, it takes money to share data. So there are a number of activities in that strategy that relate to data and sharing of information. We have 26 overall work efforts within those four strategies, and I'm not going to bore you with all of them because I could market it as an anesthetic because a lot of it is very, very detailed. But what we're talking about are, I'll give you an example, participation in the National Government Association reduction of foster care policy seminars. There's a Representative Tomei is a member of the group that's been participating with them. It's, I think, a very exciting way of learning from other states to increase our rate of innovation and bring it back to Oregon. We have technical assistance in there for program managers on a variety of child welfare issues. I think, and I think most people would agree, it's a mistake to focus in on only one small segment of a child welfare system. We have to think about it more broadly than that. I mentioned enhanced data analysis, training of community leaders, and then we're wanting to experiment with a new idea that I've personally been involved with in other states, and that's a Breakthrough Series Collaborative, which is a problem-solving methodology based on small tests of change that was actually pioneered in the medical community to reduce wait times in emergency rooms. So I'm not covering all of these because I want to preserve your time. You've got a list of them there, and we can give you as much detail about the individual work plans as work efforts as you would like. Lastly, I should talk about the six goals. These are very broad goals, and I think Aaron wants to speak more specifically about some of them. But they're fairly straightforward. Safely reduce foster care by 20%, increase relative placements by 50%, reduce the children entering care by 10%, increase foster care exits by 20%. I mentioned about the disproportionality index. And we have to do all of that by holding the abuse and neglect reoccurrence rates at what they are or lower than today. Because you're not helping anybody by allowing children to keep children out of the system and then not account for what happens to them after that. So we want to make sure that we pay attention to the hydraulics in this system. Project oversight will be through a new structure with both agencies, and then there will also be private and community participation in that. Our partners at Casey will also be a member of helping guide this process forward. I know that was very, very quick, and I'll turn over the microphone to either Nikki or Aaron and help respond to any questions you might have. Thank you.
Chairman, members of the committee, just one last point about the goals you see here. I wanted to emphasize a couple of points. One, these are in draft form. They're currently being refined by the team that is working with us on the NGA grant to drill down a little deeper on a few of them to get as specific as we can. And this is a team of people who are involved, not just in this effort, but also on our Child Welfare Advisory Committee and several other groups that work both with the Commission and with the Children, Adults, and Families Division, again, to make these goals applicable to all of the efforts that are going on, including our federal review and our program improvement plan, including many of the individual efforts that were started outside the Casey agreement. And I think what you don't see here are some additional goals that we are also setting for ourselves in the Children, Adults, and Families Division about keeping kids who are in care safe and healthy. And I don't want to let that slip everyone's minds. It's something that we take very, very seriously and are working on in addition to these efforts. What this is designed to show, I think, are some of the goals that the Casey efforts in particular are going to help Oregon achieve. And I think for me coming into this role as interim, I just want to say that I really do believe that as we move forward with the conversation around what our priorities are, that measuring our progress is really critical. I think that it is going to be a challenge for us in this current economic environment to get to the targets that we're setting for ourselves, but I nonetheless believe that it's very important for us to set those targets and to be able to identify what's working well, how we're working toward those, and then have a conversation with you, with the governor's office, about what else we could do, what else we should be doing, both in the form of policy and practice. And it's been difficult, I think, because we've had a lot of data, and one of the things that's exciting about the data piece in the Casey agreement is I think it's going to help us better utilize the data, make the data and information more transparent, and also then allow us to work more with our partners around the goals that we share for our system. In other words, I really do believe there are certain things that are most definitely the responsibility of the Children, Adults, and Families Division. However, we cannot alone do these things, and I think that it is important for me in this role to be having conversation with the Addictions and Mental Health Division and our addictions and mental health providers in the community, to be having conversations with our public health departments, to be having conversations with our medical community, to be having conversations with our commissions and families about what we can do together to achieve these goals. And so I think that having them on paper, having them be very clearly laid out and asking both our community of child welfare practitioners as well as the partners that support us what we can do together is really absolutely the right thing to do for kids. So even though this is framed within the context of the Casey Agreement, this is really about the broader conversation that we want to be having as a state about how we serve our most vulnerable kids.
Thank you so much. Thank you, the whole panel. Any questions of this panel? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a really quick question, but before I ask it, I just appreciate what you're all doing. One of you alluded to this. One of the unfortunate results of downtime is going to be more pressure on your area. There's going to be more kids either neglected or abandoned. That's just part of a down economic time. Doesn't mean we don't keep trying. I'm very pleased about the partnership, particularly when you look at the costs. The budget cycle that this legislature is going to face is totally different than the one we're going to face. You mentioned, Doctor, that there was one source. You're talking about the matching potential, and I didn't hear you. What was that source?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, there are a number of roughly about 60 cents on every dollar that is spent on child welfare services in the state and many other states comes from the feds. The largest funding source that the feds have for foster care is Title IV-E, which is part of the Social Security Act. I believe that some portion of these activities in the agreement and some portion of activities already being accomplished over at the commission may be matchable. And in the agreement, we have funding for a federal matching expert who'll come here in December to work through with us everything that we intend to do to see if we can match some of this money with 4E.
Good. Thank you.
Thank
you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here. It's good to get an update on this. This is an exciting opportunity for the state, and I would like to see the broader document that wherever you are, I don't know if that's the proposal you made to Casey Family. I'm just curious what the other 26 items are. Just, and you don't need to answer a question, but if you want to share the rest of the report or some other document that we, so you don't have to go through them now, that would be helpful. But I want to get to the six goals section. I think this is the right way to go. And I guess in my head I'm picturing some kind of flow chart. At the end of the long document are these goals and the different tracks that we get here. You know, we've been talking about the different things that could help us do these things. Just for example, the policy option package about placement of domestic violence advocates in offices. You know, the sooner we can get the parent taken care of, the child can go back, that kind of thing. 1 through 4 are very interrelated, and I guess what I'm struggling with is, are you in the, how far along can we have that flow chart? Because by the time we get to the session, you know, these are our long-term goals, but there are a variety of things that will get us there in addition to the training and capacity building that the Casey money will provide us. So anything you can provide for us to advocate for these long-term goals and what we're trying to decide on in session would be really helpful.
We have started the flowchart. This is draft right now. It's not inclusive of policy option packages, and so we could certainly, you know, put an addendum that would describe where we believe some of the policy option packages that are both in the DHS and the commission budget relate to the goals that we're setting. What this flowchart is designed to capture is really two things. One is are the strategies that the Casey Agreement has identified, coupled with some of the expertise that we're gleaning from our work with NGA, and on top of that, some of the efforts that are going on within CAF already with respect to, for example, the program improvement plan that we are required to final, that we will be finalizing in the next month, I hope, with our federal partner around our federal review, et cetera. So one of the things we've tried to be really cognizant of is what we think we can do within existing resources and what then, you know, we could do even what more we could do if we had additional resource. And as Representative Gilliam very astutely pointed out, I think it's important for us to keep both those things in mind, but we certainly could provide an addendum that would say these are some of the things that could be done to really enhance or expand on this. I will give you one example that we did testify about in September, which was the targeted addiction treatment resource that came in for families, specifically in child welfare. In follow-up to that conversation, we've been looking further at the kinds of families that originally were identified as eligible for those resources, and we're in the process of expanding the group. I believe, Representative Kotick, you had asked a question about which families were eligible, which weren't, and be happy to provide you a little bit of an update on where we are with that more specifically. With some help from the Addictions Division, but I believe that resource is one that will significantly impact our ability to get children home and out of foster care, because their families who are in recovery and are safe will be able to take their kids home. So there are certainly a lot of efforts, both that were made as part of the 07 session and that are outside the KC and NGA conversation, that relate directly to the goals, and I think that's why we feel comfortable setting them. If it was just about the 26 work efforts, I'm not sure we would feel like we could get to what's identified here on this page. They're aggressive, but we do believe with everything that's going on that they are achievable.
All of it. Thank you. Well, and I actually will say it. If we depended on the money from Casey family to get to these goals, I don't think we can get there. And what I see the Casey money for is it's that extra, you know, pot of money and juice we need to do the training and the data. And, you know, there are some, you know, tools that we need to achieve these things. But I think it's really going to be important to say, what are we doing now that's going towards these goals? What should we maybe be doing additionally if it's resource, you know, additional resources? What I'm really worried about is if we don't have a good, strong menu of the all the interrelated programs and initiatives right now, we might end up losing significant parts as we go into the budget discussion if we don't know how they all tie into the long-term goals. Family resourcing connection in the TANF program. The goal there is to keep TANF-connected families out of child welfare system. So all those things, I think, get us to those goals. But, I would, you know, the $3 million from Casey Family is fantastic, but it's, unless you know something I don't know how you get your goals just on that, so...
Thank you.
Okay. And Chair Tomei and members of the committee, what I will say is, yes, the $3 million is a small amount of money, but we are really hoping as we move through this process and we start to see some data and positive data, that we also are going to involve other people in the foundation community. So it's not going to be just Casey family programs. We're hoping that Annie Casey is going to become a partner, and we are also talking to the foundations within the state of Oregon, because they have, especially the Oregon Community Foundation, has certain interests in certain, you know, issues. So we're hoping that this is only the beginning of what we can do in leveraging those additional private dollars.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotick, one other point that needs to be made in addition to the small amount of money is that Casey is in a position to be a national expert on some things that we're interested in accomplishing. So it isn't just cash. It's connecting up with a lot of people, a lot of smart people who have thought about this for a long time. One of the most attractive features to an outside funder about the state of Oregon is that there's a long tradition of innovation here in the child welfare system, and there are a lot of things currently underway that that lend momentum to this. So I don't think anybody would expect a couple of million dollars to make a big difference, but it does coordinate a bit. So.
Representative Maurer and Representative Gelsey and I have been also involved in a group that has looked at children going into homes of relatives and kith. I like that word. So we'll talk a little more about a bill that's coming up, but I think we're very much in support of the direction that you're going with this. And we will be following up on this during the 09 session. So thank you all for the work that you're doing.
Thank you very much.
Very pleased. Thank you. Okay. I think we are now ready to go into a work session and look at committee bills. That's what I need to do, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I will close the informational meeting and open up a work session with the possible introduction of committee measures.
I'm just explaining what's in the packet.
Yes.
What you have. Thank you, Chair.
You have, we have seven LCs to consider today. There's a summary sheet on top of the packet at the dais with six of them. We did not get LC 505 in time to do a summary, and so if there's discussion on that, I may defer to Representative Olson, I believe, to describe that. Couple small changes in your packet. We did make a change to LC 1386. The one dated October 21st, 2008 should be the one that we're considering. There were some minor changes made to that and we didn't get to this morning. And also, did you want me to describe anything about the LC 1460 and a name change, if you wanted to change it?
Why don't we wait on that one?
Okay. And so at this point, there are people in the audience if there are specific questions, but there's a summary of each LC, at least most of them, in front of you. I can walk through the summary or just defer to questions.
We'll walk through the summary.
Okay. LC 636 does establish a commission on deaf and hard of hearing. It does a number of things that requires the commission to look for economic, social, political rights of people who are deaf, monitor legislation. And when I say deaf, I make reference to deaf and hard of hearing throughout that. I just summarized in the summary. It also requires to identify problems for people who are deaf, hard of hearing, make recommendations to legislature, act as a liaison between people who are deaf and the government, and encourage representations on boards and commissions by people who are deaf, hard of hearing.
That's we don't have this bill in front of us, right?
636 should be in the packet.
Yep, it's right on top.
Might have gotten really late. Does also set up a fund for the commission and allows it to receive gifts, donations, and grants. LC 1235, do you want me to proceed?
Why don't we take one at a time? Yes.
Madam Chair, can I just chip in a little bit?
Sure.
With what Rick just shared on 636. This is almost identical to the bill that we moved during the 07 session, if you remember, and then it just kind of died in Ways and Means. So.
And I want to point out, it's my intent to present all of these as committee bills. It does not require you to vote for the final bill. In fact, it may not even be heard in our committee or in any committee. So it doesn't bind you for any future vote or support. But it just, I would like to get them in the hopper so that they can be worked on. Representative Maurer, you look amused.
No, never mind.
Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, are these consistent with what we talked about in the last meeting that we were going to?
Well, yes. Did we talk about this bill, the deaf and hard of hearing? This was new to me, and I think it was one that you had picked up from the last session.
Yes.
And we didn't talk about it at the last meeting, correct?
We did not.
So,
with that exception, the rest are what we had. No.
No.
Okay, never mind. We'll get to it. Fine.
Okay. Do we want to vote on this now, or do you want to wait on this one? Do you want to vote on this now?
Do them in block if you'd like.
Do you want to do them in a block?
Ooh.
Sure.
Actually, that makes it a lot easier and cleaner
if you
wanted to do it that
right.
way.
Okay. Sure. So any other questions on 636?
Chair, can I?
Yes.
Can I just to make sure I completely understand? I still feel I'm a little new to this, interestingly enough, but a committee bill does not require. I've had discussions with folks that a committee bill would somehow guarantee a hearing or guarantee
anything.
All it does is move it into the process earlier on behalf of the committee.
Right. That's my understanding. Rick, any correction there? Okay.
Well,
thank you.
It disassociates any specific names.
That's true.
So if this was your baby, then it's no longer your baby, correct?
Well, you
can
make it your baby.
Figuratively,
that's true.
When printed, it will appear with the committee's name at the top versus sponsors.
Okay. Thank you.
That's bill laundering. Yes. Bill laundering?
Will laundering?
Laundering.
Oh, laundering. Oh, that could be.
That only happens in the revenue committee. We're extremely transparent here.
Okay, we ready to move off that one's off 636? Okay, 1235.
Chair, members of the committee, LC 1235 does set up requires state police to set up a mental health database to aid law enforcement agencies in assisting people with mental illness and developmental disabilities in obtaining services. It allows community mental health directors to input and remove data, and requires these directors to get written consent of the individuals or the guardian or appropriate legal person before information can be put on the database. Does require DHS to develop a form to submit this data and revoke information from the database, and does outline then exactly the specific types of information that would go in the database. I didn't enumerate it on the summary. And then it does require the community mental health and developmental disability directors to report annually to the local public safety coordinating council on the use of the database.
And we had a hearing on this in Albany, correct?
We did.
During the last session. We talked about this, and there was certainly got lots of input from the community and the stakeholders in this issue. And I think, Representative Olson, you've been working on this, and I think now it is voluntary. The information that goes into this would be voluntary. So
exactly.
It is not requiring anyone to provide information that they don't want in this. So... any questions or concerns about this?
So that is the primary change. Is it went from?
I think so. Huh?
Essentially, that's right. Well, to streamline it, the individual would go to your local county mental health director form and use a form that's going to be developed by Department of Human Services. That then they're required within 7 days of receiving that to move it forward then to LEDS, that it would be entered in at that point. The one part that was added to this was to clearly identify what the disorders were that come from the American Psychiatric Association.
Any further questions? All right, thank you. Moving on to 1380.
Thank you, Chair. LC 1380 does a number of changes to the TANF, or Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, program. It does reorganize all the provisions into one series to which definitions in ORS 41120.01 apply. It does require Department of Human Services, DHS, to prescribe eligibility requirements for temporary assistance to victims of domestic violence that support family safety. It does require assistance payments of no less than three times the federal poverty level, or FPL. And does lay out specific information on how DHS will determine both need and amount granted into the TANF program. It also modifies some definitions of aid, money payments to pregnant women and spouses, and then removes references to TANF program from statutes addressing adoption of foster care or foster care.
Representative Kotek, I think you've worked more on this than any other member of the committee. Do you want to speak to this?
I would be happy to, but I must confess that I am far behind in talking with the department on this, and I don't know if it makes sense. You know, we did not talk about this last time as one of the bills that would be coming forward. I don't see anything that we didn't talk about in 07 in terms of next steps for the program, you know, in terms of the income and, you know, the additions around domestic violence and making sure that that grant makes more sense in terms of how the amount is determined, I think makes sense. But I don't know how much time we have. I don't know if it's review from the department. I really am not totally up to speed on these.
Department, want to speak on this?
And Chair, these LCs were sent to the Department of Human Services. I don't know how much analysis they will need on them as well.
This did not come from me, so.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
And I have one very specific question for the department.
All right. Do you want to ask it right now?
I will. And that is about the payment of not less than 300% of the FPL. Can you explain that? I mean, it seems... I guess I'm questioning what that means.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Vic Todd, Administrator for the Office of Self-Sufficiency within the Children's, Adults, and Families Division of the Department of Human Services. With me is Sophia Esparza, who is the Interim TANF Program Manager. Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I think what you're referencing there may just be a little confusing in that description. What that's referencing is the maximum amount that could be paid to a domestic violence victim. And so in the LC, that 1380, what it's saying is that it would be 300% or three times what the maximum payment standard is for a family of three for a TANF grant. And so that just sets a maximum threshold. That threshold currently is $1,200, and it's been there since 1991 or 92. And so this, I believe, is trying to address that that level to make it a more viable structure.
Okay.
Quick question on
that. Sure.
If it's 1,200, what would roughly three times for a family of three be today then?
1,920. I believe, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I believe it would be about 1,450, something in that neighborhood.
Any further questions?
Just a comment on that. I really do think it's kind of confusing the way it's worded here. The explanation is very different from what I read in here. So as we work this bill, we might want to try for some clarification.
Oh, we'll be working on all of these bills a lot.
Yes,
this is just
but I just think that highlights something that really does need some attention.
Any further questions or any comments you'd like to make?
Chair Tomei, we appreciated having the opportunity to see this, and while we have a few comments, we can do that offline with staff. However, there's, it's more clarification, I think, in terms of, discussing it. This aligns closely to a policy package that we had in our agency request budget, so I think it's more just clarifying things.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Just for clarification, I thought that I heard Representative Kotek say this didn't come from her.
No.
And I think I'm hearing the department say it's not coming from them. Where did it come from? Do we know?
The LC Ferry?
Again, I would say, in my initial read of this, it's capturing things that we talked about. For example, if you recall back in 07, we talked about, how do we adjust the eligibility level and the grant level. Some of that is in here. It's a common variety of things in here, but, I'm not clear who the TANF Ferry here is. So.
It was based on a policy option package description that we received from DHS. I'm not sure who exactly submitted it, and it was basically the committee decision to submit it as a committee request. So I'm not sure. The genesis is Department of Human Services. I'm not sure if it's still going forward or not.
The department is saying no, so maybe we'll want to hold this one off. Is there anyone who wants to champion this one to be a committee bill?
Chair?
Yes.
I think it's helpful to know where it came from, but before we decide not to put it in, would we have another vehicle by which to address these issues? I mean, knowing that we have the opportunity to work the bill and change the bill under the relating clause.
I think it would be helpful to move this as a committee bill with the understanding that I am looking at some changes, what I'm calling a housekeeping bill, some things particularly related to parents of scholars. I assume we'll have a similar relating clause, but it never hurts to have another. I don't think there's anything that's going to embarrass us by moving it forward as a committee bill. However, the relating clause is helpful. A lot of these things we did talk about, I think the challenge with the TANF legislation, it's always like, what does this mean? Because it's a very complicated set of statutes, but I didn't see anything. The department's not raising any huge red flags. I mean, nothing surprised you in here, so. But that's all I'll say on this.
Okay.
Mrs. Sullivan, looks like you have something to say.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Department of Human Services. You know, in the last few years, we've been very actively making the department more transparent, and that's, I think, a good thing. Sometimes it comes back to kind of get us in a situation like that, and that is that we've been out in the field, we've been to many meetings, many commission boards, wherever, talking about our legislative concepts and our POPs. I think in this particular case, what happened was that somebody saw one of our POP/LCs, and that actually, I believe, Chair Tomei might have gotten a copy of one, and staff sent that to LC to have it drafted like ours. So while it sort of looks the same as ours, it's really not ours. We didn't forward it through your committee. So it kind of is and isn't ours. So I think it's fashioned after the LC and the POP that we currently have in our hopper. So I think that's how it kind of happened. Mr. Bokobian, is that how it happened? I think that is how.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And so then we were then given the opportunity to comment on it, and that's why Vic was asked to be here by Mr. Bokobian, and a number of our other staff were asked on other LCs. So when they come up and talk about it, they're just telling you what they do.
Information, not
see some things in the LC that might have been, misdefined or whatever. So we're just here to help. We're glad to work with you during the session on actual bills that get dropped. And just to kind of clarify, we will also be putting fiscal impacts on any of these LCs that have fiscal impacts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That helps.
Thank you.
The legislative concept that is in the hopper that relates to your policy option package, that will or will not go forward? Does that depend on the governor's office saying it goes forward?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, as you know, we've put quite a healthy agency request budget forward based on sort of a needs-based budget. We were very excited about that last spring when we started this whole thing, and our excitement has waned as each ensuing forecast has come out. That is, our agency request budget has been given to the governor, and it's now up to the governor to, what he will and will not put in his GRB. I think we don't know at this point. We have not been given the list, but as you know, the economy is not looking too good, and the general fund is not looking too good. So we actually don't know at this point. But it's out there, and if it gets in, it does. If not, you have your vehicle.
Any further questions of this panel? My inclination is to keep this as a committee bill, because it's another tool if in the next session we want to use it. Does anybody have problems with that? Representative Maurer, you look puzzled.
We had a little note that was passed that says, do we need to establish a paternity test for LCs? I guess I'm less inclined to include it, because we can add it at a later point. Is there a point which we can't add it? I mean, if all you're looking for is a relating clause, then we could do it in the first week of session, if that's what you're looking for.
We could do it in the first week of session if we were prepared to do it the first week of session.
This gives us more
time and more ability, I think.
Okay. So is there a relating clause that's going to appear from the department that's similar to this one?
Representative Tomei, Representative Maurer, and that really depends on what gets funded in the GRB.
Oh.
And the paternity question actually is a good question, because we represent the governor, and we support the governor's recommended budget and the governor's recommended legislative concepts that turn into bills. It's not to say we can't come and help you fix a bill or testify on a bill and say it's a great bill, but we can't support it because not in the GRB. So that happens, and so the paternity is sort of important at this point, so that it's clear that we're not trying to forward this behind the scenes.
Right. And
okay.
Are we okay? All right. I think if there's nothing else, I'll let this panel go. You're okay with this?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I didn't expect that.
LC 1381, if you look on page 2 of the LC draft, line 1, you'll see a change from 6 to 12 consecutive months. What this does is basically change for non-relative foster care that a non-relative cannot establish that relationship until at least 12 consecutive months of providing care for that child. And then at the very end it does, page 4, make it effective for foster parents on or after the effective date of this act. And basically what this does is basically, I think, extend the time by which so foster parents can enter into a more substantial relationship with a child and basically intervene in a legal manner.
And this is what we had talked about.
Yeah. There was a question the origins of this issue, and it came out of a sensitive review, and that was a consensus from the group. But I still think that, you know, from the public standpoint, that there needs to be a lot of discussion because there was consensus in the group, but there may be reasons not.
And we need to hear that. Absolutely. Any further questions on this issue? Okay, moving along. 1386.
This does create the general assistance program in the Department of Human Services for people who are help support people with disabilities who are pursuing SSI or supplemental security income or Social Security disability payments. Does provide then a monthly cash assistance, grant medical assistance, and care case management. It does establish a general assistance or GA program fund, and that allows the state to recover those cash grant funds when the person does ultimately get SSI or SSDI. It does establish, and it's not outlined in the summary, the specific amounts and items that can be counted as substantial gainful activity or resources in determining a person's eligibility for the program. And I believe this is this one.
Yeah, this one's mine. Okay. Thank you, Chair Tomei.
This is an issue we have discussed at length in the previous committee meetings.
So when last we met, we talked about general assistance, and you asked me to make sure we got this before the committee for a committee bill. It is more or less House Bill 3139A from the 2007 session. I apologize for the we had a version of the draft from October 9th. We have a new one before us from the 21st. I did get some feedback from some of the advocates to make some minor changes, which I'm comfortable with, but I'll be honest, I don't know if I could explain them terribly clearly. It might help to have Mr. Mullen come up if you want to have what the difference between the two are. But essentially, it's what we had talked about last time, that we need to do, you know, reestablish general assistance, make it clear who can apply and who cannot. Just to be transparent, we did get some comments from the department. They have some concerns. They're very similar to the ones they had last time. I don't think we need to go into them here, but obviously we'll see them if we end up hearing the bill in the session.
Okay. Are we okay with this? We don't need to have anybody else.
That's a great idea.
Okay, great. Okay, and now 1460, which is the bill that Senator Mona Sanderson spoke to us about.
Right, and I will not reiterate what she said. Basically, does change the name from the council to does change the name and include some other state entities in the decision making on that, and does broaden the duties of the board to encompass some of the UWI recommendations that come out of the Department of Human Services.
Representative, what is your name? Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, I'm easily confused, and there was a reference to the video care reimbursement issue.
She was referring back to the previous speakers. Who were concerned, especially Representative Cowan's concern, that in the rural areas that they're having trouble with medical
nothing
personnel.
To do with this bill.
Nothing.
That's
what I bill in the Senator's committee she was referencing.
Thank you very much. Fine, go ahead.
The early comments, Senator Mona Sanderson.
Yeah, okay.
Any questions?
We don't have a telemedicine bill.
Do we include the
No, we don't. Yes.
Also, on the record, Senator Miles Sanderson did note that the wording should have said change his name of the council to the Governor's Council on Substance Use Disorder instead of Abuse. We've checked with Legislative Council, and it would be permissible for the committee to introduce this with a basically a scribbler error change in it, using the word abuse from abuse to use just in the name. So that's allowable if you so desire.
Any other concerns, questions? Okay, I just want to reiterate, this does not mean that these bills will even get a hearing, much less that you are committed to voting for them, or either in the committee or on the floor of the House. So.
Pardon?
One more.
Oh, well, what's 504? And then LC 505, and since I didn't get a chance to really go through that at length, I would like to defer to Draft Representative Olson to describe that one.
Okay. Thank you, Rick. Madam Chair and members, LC 505 is basically, well, it's something that the Chair and I have been appointed to by the Governor's Office to be on the Psychiatric Security Review Board, PSRB, task force that we've been on now for several months.
Since February.
But one of the things that we noticed, because she's been affected, the chair's city in Milwaukee's been impacted with PSRB home, as well as Albany has been, and it continues to be an issue that at least the governor recognized was a big problem in our state. So we've been tasked with this. This is an easy solution, what 505 does. It basically, at the very beginning, if you take a look at ORS 169-690, it addresses in that statute that there would be a citizen advisory committee. Well, having talked with a number of folks in a little subcommittee, the last work group over the last couple months, we came up with this. All it basically does is go through your local public safety coordinating council of each county, and there's only, I think, three or four counties that do not have these lip syncs that are located in the counties. But of those that do, they would appoint the subcommittee, which on the back page, page 4, identifies who are members of that subcommittee then from the lip sync. Your district attorney, mental health director of the county, and then also a law enforcement representative either from the county or the city police department, respective of, you know, the jurisdiction. Now, having talked with Mary Claire from PSRB, she likes this bill or this LC. There's a little tweak that we need to do with that, and it's a timeline type thing that she's interested in seeing, and I think that's a great idea that the subgroup and the lip syncs would then return back in a appropriate time period to get back to PSRB for placement of a home. And the other thing that was a mild tweak was the League of Oregon Cities, as well as your counties wanting to have somebody representing them as well. So that would be an easy fix as well. This could very easily be the solution that I think the governor would be interested in, mainly because there are three things that we're interested in. One, that it's transparent. The governor's office did want that. The second thing is that there is a voice for the community for placement of a PSRB in their home. And then the third thing that I think is very important is to maintain the integrity of the PSRB itself. So, and I honestly do believe that this accomplishes that.
And a great deal of this has to do with federal law, federal
exactly.
fair housing law. So we're not exactly sure. This may not be what we end up with, but it's a great start. We had thought about waiting until the committee itself, which will be meeting again in November, came up with a suggestion, but I knew that Representative Olson had this draft, and I suggested that it be part of the committee bill. We're not stopped, and we can move on it. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I just had a quick question on that issue of LOC kind of wanting that voice of the community. Was there any discussion about adding to that local public safety coordinating council a voice for the clients that are there, maybe DRO, Disability
Thank
Rights
you.
Oregon?
Yes, yes. There, that was one, and that is one. Thank you for bringing that up. I do want to plug that in.
Great.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes. Yeah, and just to clarify, so the intent is notification, not there would not be a decision making or a how would the coordinating council be able to yay or nay something or
no.
just they're just
no.
getting notified? Okay.
Well, what the subgroup does is actually step in and help PSRB with the placement. I mean, with the Olmstead decision and also with the Fair Housing Act, because that's driving this. We'd at least have a voice, you know, in the community to say, okay, well, this is where we'd like to have the home. This makes best sense to put it in this type of environment. And I can give you a couple different examples, but that's a lot of what this was designed for.
Come on in. Please do.
It's so wonderful to see children here. I'm part of the process.
Any other questions about this issue? Okay, I'm ready, Representative.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move that the following LCs and the following dates be introduced as a block as committee bills. Be LC 636, which is dated 6/18/08, LC 1235, dated September 23rd/08, LC 1380, which is dated 10/13/08, LC 1381, dated 10/20/08, LC 1386, dated 10/21/08, LC 1460, dated 10/8/08, and then finally LC 505, dated 5/30/08.
Yes, Representative Kotek.
Do we need to move to make the change on the on? Okay.
I'll just make a with appropriate wording or something like that. Just make a motion to.
I'm talking about 1460 changing abuse to use.
Right.
So what are you saying?
Oh, it just I can't remember what was the.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, and then along that line too with LC 1460, I'd make a motion to identify the change in the wording for substance abuse to substance use that Senator Montes Anderson had pointed out to us.
Right.
Thank you.
Representative Olson moves that the LCs that he just, do I need to say them all over again? That he just stated and the dates be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since you presented them as a block, I certainly will support them. I just want to go on record as saying I think we should probably drop 1380.
I'm sorry. What was 1380? Are you okay voting?
I will, but I just
okay.
want to be sure it was clear. I thought, even with the discussion, it doesn't seem that it ought to be in our group. But that's just me.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion? All right. Any objections? If not, the measures are introduced as committee bills. That's all I have to do, right? All right. Any other business for the good of the committee? My intent is probably, unless we have some pressing business, probably not to have another meeting before session begins. If you have a pressing need, Representative Cowan, you haven't come up. We were hoping that you would come up with something.
Would you like a status
sure.
report?
Okay.
You're referring to the subcommittee's work on seniors and people with physical disabilities. It's not gone. I just don't have something to share as a committee bill. And the reason for that is that this is a fairly comprehensive conversation. It's not limited to one item. And when you get into a comprehensive and collaborative discussion with all of the stakeholders, it doesn't just pop out as a single issue very quickly. So what I have done is we've reviewed very carefully the department's initially proposed policy option packages, and we are watching. They're fairly comprehensive. Take off the listing of Senate Bill 1061 that passed in 08, and they have a policy option package or two around virtually all of the items that were listed in that bill. And so the challenge now is to kind of see whether any of those concepts survive into the governor's recommended budget. Meanwhile, the stakeholders group continues to meet, and we'll meet again on the 7th of November when they are being asked to prioritize that list. And I have a draft sort of sitting in LC on the shelf waiting for me to tell her what specifics I would like her to elaborate on in that bill. So what we'll try to do is pick up some pieces that are not likely to make the governor's recommended budget but are prioritized by the stakeholder group, and it will come back as a fairly comprehensive bill with whatever pieces of this probably three biennium effort that we'll put together around the needs to stabilize the system, but whatever pieces we think might be the most critical to discuss in the 09 session, and hopefully with a little piece of revenue attached to it to help move some of those forward. So there will be a bill. It is in drafting, but it hasn't been clarified enough to be finished with the drafting process at this point. Does that clear it up a little bit?
Thanks for all the work. I know you put in many, many, many hours on this issue, and I appreciate you doing
that. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm not in the put it off stage, but I think it's very important that the coalition that has formed have a chance to work through the process and be part of the process of what comes out. Ultimately, if I have to pick and choose off the list, I will do that.
All right. Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to offer to all of you and update you on the committee bill we had last February that related to the database and abuse and developmental disability system. There's been an enormous work group that has worked in the interim. It's had over 30 members on it, law enforcement, district attorneys, prosecutors, lots of defense attorneys and prosecutors, the Department of Human Services, advocates, labor, and there will be a very large bill that will be coming forward. Similar to Representative Callan, we're still working on refining that and in the process right now presenting that to a bunch of different stakeholder groups. And if any of you are interested in coming and hearing those, it's actually expanded and looking at all adult vulnerable victims, including seniors and people with mental illness. I think we have about a dozen presentations scheduled over the course of the next 3 weeks, so you're welcome to come to any of those or contact me and I'll get the information to you.
Thank you, Representative Gelson. Representative Cowan.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing that up, and I would just like to note that knowing that you're working on that, and with that in mind, I'm going to take the abuse reporting piece off of the package of stuff that we've been talking about for seniors at this point, because I appreciate the fact that it's rolled into what we're looking at, and that's just sort of one piece of the puzzle that the other group doesn't have to chew on. So I won't be attending your hearings because I'm going to be away for a couple of weeks, but I appreciate the seniors and people with physical disabilities piece of the long-term care being included in that, and we'll kind of take it off the other list, as we have also done with general assistance with regard to those people applying for SSI, because those are all issues that have come up repeatedly in all of the conversations that we collectively have been having with a variety of people, and it makes sense to kind of focus those into each of the work groups and not try to put them in everything.
Good. I'm co-chair of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance with Representative Rosenbaum, and we'll be looking at several different concepts that we'll be bringing, but they weren't ready for this to be preset or to have as committee bills, but I'll try to pre-session file them and talk with you about them later. Any other business anybody wants to share? Any other questions, concerns? All right. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you for being on time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We won't all be together probably as one group again.
I didn't know that.
Well, unless we all get appointed and we're all doing the same thing next session. But thank you for your great leadership.
Oh, thank you for a wonderful committee. I've enjoyed you so much. Those are the committee on...